Can the new movement of the commons save us from ecological catastrophe?
Beyond the insular market individualism of the United States, the commons is popping out all over internationally, especially in Europe and the global south. And there's a real need to develop new legal doctrines and principles that can help protect the commons, meaning our shared resources that are often jeopardized by market privatization and commodification.
That's journalist and activist David Bollier. His most recent book, co-written with legal scholar Burns Weston, is Green Governance, Ecological Survival, Human Rights, and the Law of the Commons. We spend the hour with Bollier talking about the commons, first about the ecological commons, and then we replay our 2010 interview with him about the digital commons. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. David Bollier is a commoner. No, we're not making a distinction between him and England's royal family. He's a proponent of the commons, an idea he defined in a 2010 interview we aired about his book on the digital commons, Viral Spiral. Here's a 2-minute clip from that interview just to give us the commons context.
The commons is both an ancient subject as well as a modern one. It has its roots in antiquity, but it's most known in English history when the commoners owned a pasture or the forest or some common aspect of land that they all had access rights to use for their own subsistence or personal purposes. What happened in over the course of several centuries is that the aristocrats and landed gentry decided they wanted to privatize the commons and use it for their own market purposes. And so you had the so-called enclosure of the commons. Well, this is, I consider, one of the paramount injustices and problems of contemporary life, the corporate and market enclosure of resources that belong to us all. And so many people are trying to reassert the commons as a way to say, no, these open spaces belong to us. No, the human genome should not be patented. No, the atmosphere belongs to us and should not be a privileged dumping ground for corporations. So the commons is really a broad-based movement to reassert collective control over things that belong to all of us, most of which belong outside of the market.
Bollier says the idea of the commons isn't inimical to markets or private property. He argues, rather, that the commons and the market need to coexist.
One should recall that the commons is always essential to markets. Even Adam Smith had a companion volume called A Theory of Moral Sentiments, in which he described how certain social morality was essential to functioning markets. It's just that over time, people could plunder the commons without it being recognized, or people were too powerless to do anything about it. In the past generation, however, we've seen technology make it much easier for corporations to exploit the commons, and we've seen the law expand to protect that as well. And furthermore, we're reaching outer limits of it. I mean, the genome, the atmosphere, the ocean seabeds, all sorts of areas that historically have been protected from market exploitation are now being open to private market exploitation and destroying our ecosphere. So in some ways, the market is going to have to learn that the Earth truly is finite and it can't continue in its current path.
That was David Bollier in 2010. He just started working on the issue of the ecological commons, the air, water, soil, forests, fisheries, and ecosystems upon which we all depend for our survival. He had the idea of developing an international legal framework to protect the ecological commons. Now, 3 years later, he's accomplished a lot, with 2 books about the ecological commons under his belt. He co-edited a book of essays, The Wealth of the Commons, A World Beyond Market and State, and co-wrote another with legal scholar Burns Weston. That one is Green Governance, Ecological Survival, Human Rights, and the Law of the Commons. David Bollier is the co-founder of the Commons Strategies Group, co-founder of Public Knowledge, and founding editor of onthecommons.org from 2003 to 2010. He now blogs at bollier.org. A senior fellow at the Norman Lear Center, Bollier is the author of more than 10 books, including Brand Name Bullies and Viral Spiral. David Bollier, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, you've written this book, Green Governance, with Burns Weston, and this is coming on top of a number of previous books that you've written. They kind of describe a trajectory from critiquing the overuse of intellectual property rights to stifle competition and creativity, for example, brand name bullies, to discussing a new digital commons as a social phenomenon in contrast to copyright. I'm thinking of Viral Spiral there. And now you've been working over the last several years on developing new international law around the ecological commons. Could you comment a bit on your progress from brand name bullies to green governance?
Well, for the past 10 or 15 years, I've been involved in studying the commons as an alternative paradigm of politics, economics, and culture, partly because I think of the impasse and stagnation of American political culture. The commons is a different way of conceiving how we can move forward. And it gives us a different vocabulary for talking about the excesses and abuses of the market as a routine matter. So I got into this partly through my life as an activist with the Ralph Nader public interest world in Washington, D.C., but in the past 10 years focused on how intellectual property and copyright law was starting to turn our shared culture into private property, so that Happy Birthday is copyrighted and company Warner Chapel Music makes $5 million a year off of it. So there's a whole series of things to be said about how copyright and trademark is propertizing culture. But I moved on to that, to the Internet, on how the Internet is a vast hosting infrastructure for creating online commons, where we don't have the market, we don't have government, but people self-organizing themselves into groups doing all sorts of highly productive things, from Wikipedia to free and open source software to open access scholarly journals. So I've now progressed more internationally because beyond the insular market individualism of the United States, the commons is popping out all over internationally, especially in Europe and the global south. And there's a real need to develop new legal doctrines and principles that can help protect the commons, meaning our shared resources that are often jeopardized by market privatization and commodification. So my latest book, Green Governance, is an attempt to, with my colleague Burns Weston, an international human rights scholar, sketch the framework for international and domestic law that could protect ecological commons.
So tell us, what is the ecological commons?
Well, there's all sorts of natural resources in the world, from water to forest to fisheries to wild game. And as we know from most governments and economists, they think that private property and markets are the only way to manage these resources effectively. But I think that has led to what I would call the tragedy of the market, where the resource is overexploited because the people's interest is really only the financial gain in those resources. By contrast, the commons is a group of people, usually with a local base, who have something, a deep commitment and love of a resource, be it a lake, a forest, certain areas that are special to the history of that community or town. Sometimes it's simply a big tree that has been there for centuries. And the commons is about devising collective ways to manage those resources for intergenerational stability and for not destroying what is often called the carrying capacity of the resource. So, for example, not overfishing the fishery, not taking too many trees from the forest, and so forth. Indigenous cultures around the world have perfected this art over many millennia, and there's a lot that we could learn from them. Talking about the ecological commons today is about trying to devise new mechanisms, both social and legal, for managing resources in truly sustainable ways that can help protect them over the long term.
And when you say the tragedy of the market, you're referring to the common trope, the tragedy of the commons. How are these the same or different?
Well, the tragedy of the commons idea was popularized by this biologist, Garrett Hardin, in a famous 1968 essay called The Tragedy of the Commons. And his argument was that any shared resource inevitably ends up being overexploited and ruined and so becomes a so-called tragedy. But he really wasn't describing commons. He was describing an open access regime where anything's free for the taking, and there's no rules, there's no community, there's no monitoring or enforcement of those rules. So he really wasn't describing a commons. And in fact, as social science researchers have confirmed, around the world, there are all sorts of stable, successful commons that do not overexploit natural resources, precisely because people have gotten together and seen that they have a shared interest in finding ingenious ways to prevent overexploitation, to limit consumption, to develop culture and rituals to respect nature. And that's arguably what we in the highly advanced market culture of the United States need to learn. We need to rediscover the commons and develop the systems to make it real, both in law and social life.
Now, could you give an example of that? Because, you know, I think there's the often romantic notion, you know, that indigenous people take care of the commons, and yet there are also many examples where that really hasn't happened, where, you know, you've got ecosystem collapse of the, you know, the Mayan civilization, you know, from overuse. What are the kinds of governance that have been successful in the past for people to take care of the commons?
Well, you're absolutely right that it's wrong to overgeneralize about indigenous peoples. It's just that there are many, many successful examples, and I think that they do point to the importance of identity, culture, and social practice as a way to establishing limits, something that both the market and the regulatory state have been quite unsuccessful in doing. So I think, one, we can and should study a lot of these successful commons in developing countries around the world. But in terms of our own culture, I think there are models such as land trusts, which are a fantastic example, where they are obviously a form of property, but they are treated as a commons on the inside because people can use them and they're protected over the long term. But one can also think of such things as cooperative agricultural experiments. There's a lot of interesting hybrid collaborations between Native Americans and land trusts right now. And then you can even think of something like the Highline Park in Manhattan, where a group of citizens got together and said, we want to preserve this, and they took the initiative, independent of government, to try to establish such a commons. The digital world is also giving us new tools for creating management of natural resources. I think of things such as bird and butterfly counts, where people from around a whole region or the country are aggregating their distributed sightings of different species, and they can now develop new knowledge for how species are migrating or endangered and so forth. And there's also the use of what are called participatory sensing, where people will take water quality or air quality measurements and feed them into essentially a wiki. And again, this is providing more real-time, reliable information than often the EPA has. So there's all sorts of different, one might even say, cutting-edge examples of how people are starting to collaboratively manage resources independent of government or markets and arguably more effectively.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Bollier about his latest book, co-authored with human rights lawyer Burns Weston, Green Governance, Ecological Survival, Human Rights, and the Law of the Commons. So your co-author here is a human rights lawyer. What is the relevance of human rights to this issue of the ecological commons?
Well, Professor Weston and I both agree that one problem with human rights is that it requires the vindication of those rights through the nation state, which typically is in a deep alliance with market forces. We call it the market-state duopoly. And because the market and the state are so interdependent on each other in this way, they frankly don't care about enforcing human rights when it might interfere with their market goals. So we wanted to see how the commons could be a better way to actualize human rights over the long term by giving people genuine sovereignty and control over their resources and their livelihoods in a way that the market or the state doesn't. Market and state often really cultivate dependencies on them, dependencies on being a consumer in the market, dependencies on having to get permissions from bureaucracies or legislatures that are quite remote and unaccountable. So the commons is a way of empowering people for basic human rights to livelihood, respect, dignity, and control of local resources that they depend on for their everyday lives, as opposed to market gain or profit. So Burns West and I see the commons as a way for reconceptualizing how we can protect human rights in a more substantive way in a world that is otherwise dominated by a market state duopoly that has little interest, or at least limited powers, to protect human rights better.
So now talk a little bit about how this would work. You talk about giving people genuine sovereignty, yet they do live within the context of generally a globalized economy and a state that seems ever more willing to exercise its power on behalf of that globalization. How does this sovereignty work?
Well, it obviously is not going to be sovereignty in the fullest sense of the nation state. The nation state's not going away anytime soon. However, we have seen how the nation state grants powers, delegates powers to collectivities of shareholders known as the corporation. I don't see why the nation state couldn't do similar delegations of power chartering of commons. In Italy, for example, there are municipalities that have entered into, we've heard of public-private partnerships. They've developed public commons partnerships, which are an interesting way of empowering people. So it would be a quasi-sovereignty, one might say, but it would be a significant carve-out that would give people genuine responsibility as well as genuine entitlements. And what I think is wholesome and positive about this is we have a crisis of legitimacy in the nation state. People don't trust it, often for very good reason. And I might add, this is particularly so in the age of the Internet, when people can coordinate and communicate with each other without being all of it going through the government, although, of course, that's now in jeopardy, too. So what I'm saying is that long-term, the nation-state governments are going to have to find some sort of way of dealing with this crisis of legitimacy and trust. And I think commons are a terrific way, a practical way, of enabling people to take some measure of significant control over their lives and provide stewardship of resources, drawing upon energies that otherwise don't have a role in how we manage natural resources.
So give us an example. What is going on in Italy with these public commons partnerships?
Italy, the commons is a term that has some mainstream political currency because several years ago there was a national referendum on whether to privatize the local water systems, and it was resoundingly defeated by actually an astonishing 94-95% of the vote. And all of this was using the word commons as the alternative. And a lot of people see the commons as a way for dealing with some of the deep dysfunctions and pathologies of typical governments and bureaucracies because it brings power back down to a level where people can truly deliberate and talk about and manage in a way that makes sense rather than having the naked individual dealing with remote bureaucracies that are controlled and dominated by lawyers and lobbyists. So in Italy, one municipality has, and this is a very fledgling effort, but has entered into contractual agreements with collectives of citizens to, for example, manage a park, where the citizens have certain authorized authority, working within parameters set by the municipality in certain performance metrics, to have control and manage that park. Well, I think that's an interesting model that arguably is similar to what is done with the corporation, where the state charters a corporation to perform certain functions ostensibly in the public interest. Why not charter certain commons to take care of certain public functions, but the goal would not be to maximize profit or simple financial interests. It would be to be a long-term steward of all sorts of qualitative values beyond money and profit.
Well, it's interesting because I also have been doing some, reading and research into some new forms of corporate governance, such as the B Corporation. I work for a B or benefit corporation where written into the charter of the corporation is that its purpose is to benefit social goods. You know, profit is not necessarily the first or even the second. I mean, these are companies that need to make a profit to stay in existence, but they don't need to make a profit. In fact, they can't make a profit that would destroy the benefit to society. What do you think of that? And do you see a role for private enterprise through benefit corporations like this to join in, to enter into partnerships with the commons as well?
Absolutely. Business has an important role to play, and I think the benefit corporation is a very interesting hybrid model, one might even say a transitional model, for trying to get out of this catechism that the corporation has only fiduciary responsibilities to maximize profit. I think that companies can, as many smaller privately owned companies have shown, you can be a perfectly successful competitor in the marketplace while serving certain social and environmental goals. My interest is trying to give this a greater structural depth and definition and move beyond the market terms of reference to, frankly, non-market, non-monetary social and ecological terms of reference. And so my book, Green Governance, is about trying to not just imagine but propose certain concrete legal forms for this kind of governance. And I might add, in terms of your question about business, I think we need to differentiate between markets and capitalism. Markets, as we've seen with the local food movement, are an entirely constructive role if they are answerable to a community in a meaningful way. The problem is that so often markets are not answerable. They've become integrated with global capital and global finance, and they're simply rip-and-run exploiters of localities, and therefore the market, the genius of the market, isn't really harnessed. It's simply a tool for concentrating and accumulating money and power. So, yes, let's have a bigger conversation about how markets and commons can interact constructively.
We're talking with David Bollier about his latest book, Green Governance, Ecological Survival, Human Rights, and the Law of the Commons, co-written with Burns Weston. So you talk about some of these forms. You've mentioned forms of governance, and you've mentioned the public commons partnership. There are some other trusts. I mean, you mentioned the word trust before. In fact, there's a suit now going on in all 50 states in the District of Columbia that I believe was brought originally by a young man who was 13 when he started this, and I don't have his name at hand right now, on the public trust doctrine, saying that carbon dioxide pollution is destroying the public trust of the atmosphere. Could you talk about the history here of the public trust doctrine and how it might be used as a juridical form of international law around the ecological commons?
Well, there's this very old, one might even say ancient, doctrine that goes back to Roman times called the public trust doctrine, which states that the state cannot give away or sell resources that belong to the general unorganized public. And that's one reason, for example, we have access to beaches, and you can't, while there might be private beaches, you can't prevent people from using the beach if they come in through the water, or oftentimes there's a requirement that there be access to the beach through the land. So the public trust doctrine says governments cannot simply do what they want with what is what they claim is public or government property. There's a larger intergenerational interest at stake, and the general public has rights. Well, using this doctrine, a law professor at the University of Oregon, Mary Wood, and a large number of people, of lawyers and children, as you mentioned, have waged lawsuits in all 50 states and the federal courts, trying to convince the courts that under the public trust doctrine, governments cannot be allowed the destruction of the atmosphere. This is the so-called atmospheric trust litigation project. And there are these suits are now progressing. One has actually gotten a favorable hearing in New Mexico. And the idea is to force government to live up to its obligations under the public trust doctrine to protect the environment and not simply collude with markets or take the path of least resistance and do nothing. So this is an example of using commons-based law to try to protect the environment.
You know, in a world where even, you know, the Kyoto Protocol, minimal though it may be, has not been able to really be implemented on a global level, we see conference after conference of the, you know, the world's governments coming together to try to do something about climate change. How can this commons law movement be any more successful than the failure of international law to work out agreements on the climate?
Well, several reasons. One, you start from the premise that the traditional apparatus of liberal democracy is not going to be able to go the distance, partly because it's been so corrupted and compromised, and because government is not a honest broker, fair arbiter for the resolution of differences. And part of challenging that is creating new constituencies that are going to have a whole different framework in terms of reference and how they approach this. So, we need to start to create these new transnational constituencies, many of which are already quite well developed, but to give them this different language and framing and discourse for how we can begin to challenge this. Part of the problem is that the traditional discourse is so market-oriented and individual rights-based that we cannot see our way clear to imagine alternative frames of governance. And that's really a serious problem. So, one, we need a constituency development. Two, we need to have a different legal framework and, one might even say, worldview for approaching these problems. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck in the same level of discourse for quite some time. And I think we've seen the failure of how governments are not going to be able to mobilize. They're so distrusted, and there's such a legitimacy problem that I defy them to deal with local complexities on a global scale to deal with climate change. They simply are incapable of it. Forget about politics. Centralized institutions and bureaucracies cannot do that. Therefore, we need the kind of bottom-up distributed action that we've seen on the internet, where people can self-organize and have certain circuits of control themselves to develop alternative regimes for governance. And I think that long-term is what we're going to have to move towards if we're going to break the impasse that we're currently suffering.
Could you give some examples of those international constituencies? And does something like the organization 350.org, Bill McKibben's, the organization he began, is that an example of that?
Well, I don't know how extensive 350.org's international connections are, but certainly there are international climate change activists. And the internet has greatly empowered them and often given them greater knowledge, maneuverability, and moral legitimacy than the ruling powers they're fighting. And this is about all of those issues, at least as much as the science. But in terms of what I call transnational tribes of commoners, there are quite a few, ranging from the free culture, free software worlds of the internet to, in terms of international environmentalism, we have, of course, the climate change activism is quite developed internationally at an activist level. We have, in Latin America, many indigenous peoples movements that are quite active and cooperative on a global scale. We have the Via Campesina landless peasants movement in Brazil and elsewhere around the world. The internet has been fomenting a lot of this cooperation, partly because there's a lot of frustration with what can be accomplished domestically, and there's a lot of similarities cross-border. A lot of farmers have joined this internet community called the System for Rice Intensification, which is the equivalent of open-source agriculture. They trade advice and guidance for how to improve rice yields without using GMO crops or pesticides, and they have increased yields tremendously. So these are the kinds of fledgling alternative types of political action that are mixed in with different ways of self-provisioning for oneself and taking care of the environment.
And so, David Bollier, how do you see these international constituencies, environmental constituencies, working together to create an international law centered around the ecological commons?
Well, we're obviously at a very early stage, but I can say the Commons is getting has some robust interest around the world. There was a major conference in Berlin in May 2013 that I was involved in, which brought more than 200 self-identified commoners from diverse realms and more than 30 countries. I think there's a lot going on that is not seen by the mainstream press or political world that is quite, I think, powerful in its long-term implication, but there's clearly lots of organizing that needs to be done, new initiatives that need to be launched, new resources and funding that need to be found. But starting with an alternative vision that has that potential, I think, is where we begin, because the old systems are simply not working, and we're stuck between old systems that are not working and a new one that has not yet arrived.
So take us, assuming that we've made enough progress to at least still be around, then take us to the end of the century, to the year 2100. If it could be the way you would hope, and many of the rest of us would hope too, around a development, international commons system to protect the environment, what are some of the key elements of that? What are some of the principles, the legal principles that you envision being in sway?
Well, first of all, I see this far before 2100 because that's just too far off, and we need to happen. It has to happen sooner. It's, I think, going to be less incremental than abrupt. Just as we've seen, you know, the Berlin Wall fall, that was abrupt. And this is not going to be gradual or linear. I think it'll be happen quickly. And I think the Internet is accelerating a lot of cultural change and political change that hasn't been officially recognized. But in terms of the larger structures, it's kind of difficult to predict because these things are going to have to co-evolve and emerge. If you are familiar with complexity theory, emergence is when different things get together and over time create new structures that weren't anticipated from the lower level of organization. So it's about creating new levels of organization. I think that we're going to see a lot of nested structures at different levels, from local, regional, national, and international, that are collaborative in new ways. Just as we see in the market economy, those different tiers of activity have developed institutions to facilitate their operations, local, regional, national, global. I think the commons world is already doing that, and we see from small local projects to ones that have scaled like Linux around the world. And I think, again, the Internet will be a spine or backbone for a lot of this new innovative type of self-organized governance, which will have to come to terms in some ways with the traditional international and nation-state structures.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. David Bollier, your book, co-written with Burns Weston, is Green Governance, Ecological Survival, Human Rights, and the Law of the Commons. And you're also the author of another book, co-author of another book, The Wealth of the Commons.
And my blog is bollier.org for anyone who wishes to follow up.
That's great. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
It's been a pleasure.
We'll be back with David Bollier after the break as we hear my 2010 interview with him about the digital commons, Viral Spiral.
I'd pump my accordion a million times if pumping it would save the planet. But every time I start my car, it lets off more emissions. And who has time to ask the Earth's permission? I fly all across the country. I'm into making music for environmental causes. I'm a sucker. But every time I start my jet, it lets off more emissions. And who has time to ask the Earth's permission? Oh, 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 ozone. I'm really, really sorry.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today talking with author and activist David Bollier about the commons, the shared resources we depend on, whether they're natural, cultural, or digital. We spoke about the ecological commons and how to protect it in the first half of today's show. Now, let's turn to my 2010 interview with Bollier about his book, Viral Spiral. It's about the rise of the digital commons of the internet, a place where commonses, he says, are very easy to create because the barriers to entry are so low. I asked Bollier to say more about how the internet became such a fertile ground for the digital commons.
Well, the internet was incubated in academic computer science programs under the auspices of the Department of Defense, improbably enough. But as an academic community, they're what is often referred to as a gift economy, where people didn't have transactions the way they do in a market with cash or contracts or things like that. You gave stuff to the community, and in return, you got all sorts of benefits. Well, they constructed in the very protocols and design of the internet, made it so that it was a sharing structure, a matrix for sharing, as opposed to a place with toll booths and checkpoints to pay money. This was in the 1970s. By the mid-1990s, when the World Wide Web was invented and was unleashed on the internet, giving it far more functionalities than it ever had before, it evolved according to the design as a place where information and photos and text and video could be shared. And so we had this very unusual challenge to typical market ways of doing business, and a whole new sharing economy or sharing culture has grown up.
You mentioned this gift economy, and you have talked about the whole rise of copyright. You make pretty clear in your book, Viral Spiral, that you are not really against the very notion of copyright itself. And you just mentioned, you know, this idea of a free universe, basically, on the internet. What you really critique is what's happened to copyright. Now, so I wonder if you could go through a little bit of that. This was a subject that you treated at much more length in your book, Brand Name Bullies. But give us the gist of this.
Well, as the internet took root and people could suddenly share things with each other and create their own communities apart from the market and get useful stuff done, a lot of the traditional owners of copyright, the music industry, the film industry, the publishing houses, were profoundly threatened. And so they increasingly lobbied Congress to expand what their copyright protections would give them. Longer terms for copyright, less fair use rights, meaning the ability to freely excerpt things without paying any money or getting permission in advance. And so you had a whole array of laws passed to expand the privileges that copyright owners had at the very time when the internet was making it easy to share things for free. So you had this profound cultural clash between whether a market order as governed by copyright should prevail or whether this fledgling new order based on free sharing and minimal market activity would be able to get a foothold and grow itself. Copyright laws were enclosing our cultural commons. And my book, Brand Name Bullies, mentioned all sorts of ludicrous examples of this, where trademark law was being expanded so that, for example, the Village Voice was claiming a trademark in the word voice as applied to newspapers and suing newspapers that used otherwise.
And you even had Girl Scouts being sued for singing songs around the campfire.
The Copyright Clearance Society, ASCAP, decided that when Girl Scouts and other campers at summer camp were singing around the campfire, that was a public performance that needed that a fee had to be paid to for the songwriters and publishers of those songs.
And yet, all this time, you also talk about the fact that these corporations were appropriating what had been in the public domain for a long time. Tell us about the public domain. What are the attitudes towards it, and how is it being rescued by the internet?
Well, historically, the public domain was regarded as a wasteland, a place where you had old government documents and sheet music from the 20s and basically junk that nobody wanted unless you were some sort of curiosity seeker. And the reasoning was that if it was valuable, there'd be a price tag on it and it would be sold in the market. Well, the internet started to change that when suddenly things that didn't have a price tag on it could be shared and communities could generate stuff as well. And it was all outside of the marketplace. So over time, the public domain in the past maybe 15, 20 years began to be seen as something perhaps valuable. And in fact, we've seen how Wikipedia is a vast public domain of material that people have created, or free software and Linux, something that is not owned as traditional private property. tremendously valuable and generative. So the idea, the public domain has sort of morphed into the commons, the public domain historically being seen as inert, and it's a legal term of art, the commons being a more reflecting a social community that supports it and generates the value. So the public domain has sort of morphed into the commons in the internet world, and all sorts of tools are being created to try to protect the commons.
And then I want to go back to the first point, however, which is that, in fact, these companies are also taking what has already been common, for example, the copywriting of plants.
Well, this is an across-the-board phenomena. The Disney company, for example, built much of its empire on plundering fairy tales and other stories in the public domain, giving it a proprietary spin, and because of its market power, was able to essentially supplant the folk culture and start charging. They even sued when somebody tried to use Snow White, claiming that they owned a trademark in Snow White, even though, of course, Snow White has a long history as a folk character. But you see this as well in plants, where companies from the first world are going into India or other places with a lot of biodiversity and claiming patents in agricultural crops, and sometimes making a small genetic engineering modification and saying, now it's proprietary, even though it took centuries for the commons to cultivate that seed. So you see this phenomenon in many areas where corporations are essentially stealing from the commons, turning it into a proprietary product, and basically disenfranchising the commons from its fruits.
I want to go back to your use of the word free here, because there are differing definitions of what free means in this new internet culture. You discuss it in your book, Viral Spiral, David Bollier, when you talk about open source software.
Free has two meanings. One, of course, no cost. But the way that many people in the free culture world, meaning both free software and the Creative Commons world, describe it, they mean politically or legally free, meaning you have legal and political access to information as opposed to at no cost. So the point is to allow information and other creative works to circulate freely, meaning their circulation can't be restricted. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's no cost. So, for example, Linux is a free software program, but there's all sorts of companies that add their own tweaks and release it as a commercial product for which people pay, sometimes packaged with service and support. So the more important point is this is a political freedom that's the essential point, not that it's no cost.
Well, you've been using the term Creative Commons. Define what Creative Commons, what the Creative Commons license is.
Under copyright law, everything is born as property. You can scribble on a piece of paper or tape record your guitar riffs, and it is born copyrighted. This is under the 1976 revisions to the copyright law. Well, this sounds great, perhaps, but when the internet arose and digital technology started to proliferate, it was a disaster because it meant that everything created had an envelope of property rights around it, and so as a legal matter, could not be shared without permission or payment. So you could download something from a website or visit a website, and it would replicate a copy of that website in your computer. That's legally not allowed because you're making a copy. So all sorts of things were suddenly suspect. They may not be prosecuted, but they might. And that's the very point, the uncertainty of whether you could use things legally on the internet. So a number of legal scholars, activists, artists, computer scientists, and others, led by Professor Lawrence Lessig, got together to create what are called Creative Commons licenses. And what they are licenses in which you, as a copyright holder of a works, can say, I'm applying this license to my work to signal in advance that people can use it however they want under these conditions. And some of the conditions are, so long as you give me credit and say that I'm the author, or so long as you don't use it for a commercial purpose, or so long as you don't make a derivative work, in other words, modify or change it. So the licenses are a very important way to basically legalize the ability to share things in digital environments, especially the internet. So it's a major legal advance for countering the strict copyright control that major copyright industries assert.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with David Bollier about his book, Viral Spiral. It's about how the internet is redefining the digital commons to create social communities that generate value. So we've been talking about different kinds of license, a Creative Commons license. You yourself actually have distributed this book, Viral Spiral, under the Creative Commons license. Tell us what your restrictions are on it.
Well, my publisher had to have be persuaded that it might be more valuable to do this. Let me just tell a story that a friend of mine said that really there's only one thing worse than being sampled on the internet, and that's not being sampled. So the point is, a lot of value is created simply by being accessible and available on the internet. So my book is available on the internet at www.viralspiral.cc and can be downloaded for free under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License, meaning you can do whatever you want with it provided you acknowledge that I'm the author and you don't use it for a commercial purpose. I've had more than 1,000 downloads already. There's many authors out there who have built their careers upon releasing their books online because it gives them visibility, and they still sell many, many commercial hardcover books and make money.
Copyright originally came about in order to protect the livelihoods of artists, to ensure that at least for a certain period of time, and originally it was 20 years, as you point out in the book, that's now become the lifetime of the author plus 75 years, I believe it is. So there's a big difference between the two. But how are people going to make money by releasing their work under the Creative Commons license?
Well, we're kind of caught in what I call an interregnum, a transition period, because a lot of the existing industries are very reluctant, if not downright hostile, to changing their business models. They have too much invested in the infrastructure and ways of doing things. You know, the movie industry, the music industry, they don't want to change. And yet the newcomers haven't been able to get enough of a foothold to grow new business models that are based on an easier sharing and non-exclusivity of content, although we're starting to see it. So in different creative sectors, it's working out in different ways. How do we come to terms with the radical efficiencies of the internet? I call this the great value shift, meaning that more value is created by being open and accessible than being exclusive. Copyright is based on being exclusive, but that's a one-way ticket to oblivion and no value. Value is created by people tuning into what you're doing, sharing it, circulating it, and that's why you see lots of TV shows putting their stuff on the web for free, because they want to be known. They want people talking about them. So there's this tension that is still being worked out in each one sector after another. Should we make the shift? How can we make the shift?
You mentioned Lawrence Lessig. Tell us a little bit more about who he is and what he did, and then I'm going to ask you a question that relates to what you were just saying.
Well, Lawrence Lessig was a Harvard law professor at the time. This was around the year 2000, and he was profoundly disturbed by the drift of copyright law and wanted to try to do something about it. And he mounted a constitutional test case against the so-called Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which was a law that the Disney company wanted because Mickey Mouse, among other characters, were coming into the public domain. Mickey Mouse was almost 75 years old, and in 2003 was going to be in the public domain. So Disney prevailed upon Congress to extend the term of copyright law by 20 years retroactively, meaning for works that already existed. And it's, of course, absurd because if copyright's supposed to be an incentive to get creators to create new things, how do you incentivize Robert Frost or Walt Disney, who are both dead, to create more things? You don't. It was just a rank giveaway to companies that had inventories of copyrighted works. So Lessig mounted a constitutional test case about this, saying the Constitution says copyright must be for limited terms, yet under Congress's act, where they had extended copyright terms 11 times since 1960, he says it's not limited anymore. Well, he lost in that case, but In the course of it, he educated much of the American people and the press about copyright law, and at the same time got this whole Creative Commons project underway as an alternative way to deal with too much copyright law.
By the way, he is an electrifying speaker, and I watched his talk on TED on YouTube the other day. At the end of his talk, he inveighs against what he calls extremists on both sides, both the Disney types, but also the kids who think that everything should be free. He says those are both very dangerous.
Well, he sees that there's much more credibility, moral and political credibility, on basing a movement of this sort around acknowledging and recognizing the value of copyright as opposed to celebrating simply using things without authorization for free. What is often known as piracy, a term that is, of course, misused and abused by the industry, but there is such a thing as using works without permission that ought to be respected. So he saw long-term value in respecting copyright and rejects some of the so-called piracy efforts. At the same time, there's a disagreement within the movement about whether such acts are really civil disobedience, which are necessary to send a signal to the industry that they're trying to impose their own regressive market relationships on people when a more open and free social relationship is what they want and many others do. So there's a tension between so-called pirates or civil disobedient people using works the way they want. One of the great things about the commons is it's not reflexively anti-corporate or anti-market. It simply wants a more respectful, mutually beneficial relationship between the two. And there's a lot of companies that are so-called open business models that are experimenting in this regard, trying to find better ways to meld what the commons creates with what they can create. And it's less dependent upon raw market power or repressive government copyright laws than a respectful conversation with the commoners and what they can produce. So, for example, there's a number of communities devoted to extreme sports, like extreme skiing, extreme skateboarding, and so forth, which are often the incubators of innovative equipment. The fans there in those sports will develop this new stuff. Well, many of them are working in tandem with the companies that produce the equipment, and it's this sort of mutually synergistic relationship. And you see online, in the same way, many of the new open business model companies are saying, we respect you as a community and want to satisfy you, and we're not going to try to have strict copyright claims. So, for example, there's a company called Magnatune, a new a music label, that has its own roster of artists, and it allows you to buy the music for between $5 and $18. You choose what the price, but you know in advance that 50% of it straight up, without any accounting gimmicks, will go to the artist. And so it's a way for people to express their appreciation to artists they like, knowing that they're not going to get jerked around and that the company is not a predatory, typical music label. And so this is one new paradigm we see in a lot of online companies where the company looks to a community to be word-of-mouth advertising, to do R&D, research and development, to provide innovations that it can capitalize on, and the loyalty and cohesiveness of the community, if focused with the company, will benefit everybody. So it's really an interesting new model that transcends a lot of the traditional adversarialism between companies and consumers.
We're speaking with David Bollier about the digital commons and the new values it's creating. It's a very exciting kind of development that you're really talking about here, and I really wonder if there's any putting the cat back in the bag.
I think increasingly less so as the internet becomes more of a social reality and more economic and cultural and creative behavior migrates online, because the dynamics online are change the economics that and the traditional real life intermediaries are losing their power, and we're kind of in a death struggle with them, and whether and how they will transform themselves, transform their business models to an online environment is really the open question.
I mean, the only real wrench in this business that a monkey wrench that I could see being thrown in here is, I think of, you know, as we speak of this increased democratization of content provision, we're also living at a time when government is becoming more secret, more controlled. We're losing our civil liberties. Do you see any kind of coming collision in terms of government control and the internet?
Well, increasingly the government is an afterthought because they can't, their policymaking is no longer as paramount or decisive as it used to be. It was almost laughable, the Supreme Court checking in on the Grokster decision for file sharing for music, whether that should be allowed or not, because whatever the Supreme Court says is going to be bypassed by hackers and new software programs. And in some ways, the power has moved from law and public policy to the technology and the social practice. It's not as if it's public policy and law is irrelevant, but it's far less influential and powerful than it used to be. So this, in its own way, is a paradigm shift from the liberal vision of government representing our interests to the sovereign control by ourselves of our own interests through our own technological means. We can't surrender those battles in Washington, but in some ways they'll come after we fortify ourselves as, if you'll excuse the term, commoners.
But in China and Singapore, they do have government control over the internet.
The internet is not necessarily as open as it is right now. People should not think that it's immutable or inevitable that the internet be open. Governments can successfully control the internet, at least sufficiently for their purposes. Long term, it'll be interesting to see if China is able to do that, both as a technical matter, but also economically. Can they grow as a country but have everything under wraps? That's really a big question, because the power, the creativity, the innovation that is unleashed through an open system, which arguably is America's great contribution to the world, can China do that too? I have my doubts whether China can grow and prosper economically without loosening itself up politically and culturally.
That was David Bollier in 2010. As we know, there have been disturbing developments in corporate control of the internet and government use of it for surveillance. So when I interviewed Bollier about his book Green Governance, which you heard in the first half of today's program, I asked him one last question. His answer shows that he's updated his thinking about the issue since 2010. In the context of the NSA revelations, the increasing control of the internet by the very governments and corporations, that partnership that, you know, is like a dead weight on the development of this new way of working together of the commons, do you fear that the internet will become corrupted to the extent that this cannot go forward?
Well, that is certainly the struggle going on right now, and I think there's a profound tension or crisis between open networks, which are fantastically productive and creative and innovative, and centralized, concentrated capital and government, the nation state. This is a profound tension that is, I think, we're just in the early stages of, but I ultimately have confidence in the power of open networks because of that's where all the juice, the energy, the human aspiration resides, whereas the others are simply structures to try to control and contain that power. So I think we're going to have different types of struggles going on that we haven't really seen before. So that struggle, I think, is really a companion struggle to the ones that I've sketched in terms of advancing the commons.
David Bollier. In November, he'll start a series of blog posts on CSRWire.com based on his book, Green Governance. I work for CSR Wire as a managing editor. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Green Governance, and also you'll find a link to download the Creative Commons copy of Viral Spiral. Find out more about the commons at bollier.org. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.